adopted as part of their own self-image. Seems a quaint, almost antebellum notion. Folks in Iowa don't strut around introducing themselves as Iowans. At least, none I know. But if you grew up in Texas, as I did, it becomes a part of you, as if you're a member of a club. It's a product of the state's enduring, and to my mind, endearing parochialism. A genetic tie to the days when Texas was a standalone nation born of its own fight for independence, which produced its own set of national myths. Ohio doesn't have an Alamo. I'm not sure Ohioans, as wonderful as they are, have a distinct culture. As a child, I was always vaguely ashamed I wasn't born in Texas. I'll never forget the day a boy in my fifth grade class actually called me a carpetbagger. How on earth would he even know what that was? The myths about Texas die so hard, mostly because Texans love them so. So much of it is wrapped up in oil. Non-Texans probably think it's all-pervasive. It's not. The fact is, growing up in central Texas during the 1970s, I never met an actual oil man. There are a few pump jacks out in the fields around our little town, but we never gave a thought to who owned them. It wasn't until I was 16, the weekend I served as an escort at Waco's Cotton Palace debutante ball, that I was introduced to the class of Texans known as the Big Rich. Boys from Highland Park and River Oaks in white dinner jackets and gleaming hair. Willowy Hockaday girls with enormous eyes and glistening jewels. Ogling them from within my rumpled rented tux, they seemed like royalty. And they were. Texas royalty, at least. They had flasks in their pockets and talked of boarding schools and weekends in Las Vegas, and the wine in Paris, and jetting to London, and my head just spun and spun and spun. It wasn't for another 5 years that, as a cub reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Dallas and later in Houston, I began to read, and write a little, about the Big Rich. Though I didn't realize it at the time, those were the years, the early and mid-1980s, when their era was ending. The fathers of those boys from River Oaks were going bankrupt. Their buildings were being sold or torn down. The state was completing a decades-long maturation, and the new Texas, chock-a-block with northern-owned corporations and Yankee executives and their shimmering office parks, was fast becoming something different and somehow artificial. A Texas-flavored Ohio. Something was being lost. I haven't lived in Texas for 20 years, but in some ways I've never left. My parents are still there. I visit often. Still, when my editor suggested some kind of book on Texas oil, I was surprised how quickly a structure sprang to mind. It took barely 30 seconds, in fact. It would be not about the oil industry, per se, but about the great Texas oil families, the ones who generated all those myths, the Hunts, the Basses, the Murchisons, the Cullens. I thought of them as the Big Four, though it wasn't until I began my research that I found they had been called exactly that, although not since the 1950s. This book is built on 3 years of research, during which I plunged into dozens of Texas and out-of-state archives, interviewed surviving members of the Big Four families, and read more than 200 books and thousands of newspaper and magazine articles. Some of the choicest information I found in county courthouses, in the mammoth, musty, suitcase-sized ledger books, where Texas clerks for decades scrawled out the minutiae of land records, oil leases, and lawsuits. The published literature is hefty, but uneven, and hasn't been refreshed since the great bankruptcies of the 1980s. There have been 4 books published on the Hunts, 2 on the Murchisons, 1 on Roy Cullen, and nothing but bits of